Lopez, as I documented in my article, are or aren't committed, or Lopez himself are committed to democracy in terms of the Constitution, and the Constitution that was shredded by something called the Carmona Decree and the coup. Lopez and his lawyers, Jared Genzer and Jose Maez, make statements of denying that he had any role, when in fact, if you look at my article, Lopez was involved in activities like PDVSA, general strike and a protest, and has made statements like on your early tape where he's clearly supporting the coup, even though he was not a signatory to the document, the Carmona Accord, that his own father, who I interviewed also, signed. I interviewed Lopez's father, not Lopez. And his father told me that he had signed not a not the Carmona Accord, but
we have 10 seconds.
He told me he signed a attendance sheet when, you know, you can see videos that there was a call to sign the accord.
Roberto Lovato, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We're going to link to your article in Foreign Policy called The Making of Leopoldo Lopez, A Closer Look at the Democratic Bona Fides of the Rockstar of Venezuela's Opposition. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Manhasset, New York, at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation Shelter Rock tomorrow night, Thursday night, for the 70th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima. And next week at the Venice Biennale, we'll be broadcasting from Venice, Italy. We have a job opening for a social media editor, full-time job here in New York. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, we have the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Waterfront Park in Portland. 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki will feature speakers and performers, including Portland Taiko, and will provide opportunities for attendees to get involved in efforts to abolish nuclear weapons. That's 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the FBI is investigating Hillary Clinton's private emails from her time as Secretary of State for potential leakage of classified documents.
Russia has claimed ownership of thousands of acres of the Arctic in search of oil.
And Pope Francis has told priests to welcome divorced Catholics and their children. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 5th, 2015. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
A loophole in a law passed at the end of last month's legislative session will mean that for 3 months later this year, a planned tax on marijuana sales will go up in smoke. The ballot measure that legalized marijuana in Oregon called for sales in dispensaries to begin in January of 2016 with the tax in effect. A bill passed last month allows for those sales to begin in October of 2015, but the tax won't be collected until the original start date. Nobody knows how much revenue the state will be missing out on, but officials say the point is moot. OLCC spokesman Tom Towsley says the Department of Revenue wouldn't be ready to collect the tax in October in any case.
Portland officials plan to triple the tax breaks available annually to developers who include affordable housing units in their projects. Commissioner Dan Saltzman, who is in charge of the Portland Housing Bureau, says increasing tax exemptions would allow the construction of 200 affordable units a year in booming real estate neighborhoods. This morning, Saltzman presented revisions to Portland's tax exemption program to the City Council. The revisions would create a deal where developers would receive a 10-year property tax exemption in exchange for making at least 20% of their units affordable. In this case, affordable is defined as being attainable to people who earn up to 60% of the regional median. The amount of tax exemptions possible would be up to $3 million, money that would otherwise go to Multnomah County and its local schools. Here's Dan Saltzman discussing the revisions at the Portland City Council meeting this morning.
Thank you, Mayor. This item would make a change to our multi-unit limited tax exemption program for affordable housing. The goal of these changes is to increase the creation of affordable housing in market rate developments. We have very few tools to incent the private market to create affordable housing. In fact, we have only two. This is one of them, and the other is our waiver of system development charges. The proposed changes to the program are to adapt to current market conditions and encourage the production of more affordable units. Currently, the program only allows applicants to apply once or twice a year, and this does not really accord to the realities of development, which is happening all the time. The changes also focus our additional public benefits we require beyond affordability on two key issues: requiring that the development have at least 5% of all the units be adaptable to individuals with physical disabilities, and additional requirements to achieve higher minority women and emerging small business participation rates. One of the biggest barriers to achieving more affordable housing is the current $1 million cap on foregone property tax revenue available for this program. So we are seeking a modest increase to $3 million per year, which we estimate can produce 200 affordable units per year.
A student who says she was raped by three University of Oregon basketball players has settled a lawsuit against the school, but controversy remains in its wake. The student, identified only as Jane Doe, received $800,000 in other benefits in exchange for dropping the suit. The suit accused the school and its basketball coach of violating her Title IX rights by recruiting the basketball players, one of whom had previous sexual assault charges on his record. All three players have been found guilty by the school and were subsequently expelled. Though University President Michael Schill characterized the settlement as an opportunity to shift focus on preventing future assaults, economics professor and blogger Bill Harbaugh wrote that more needed to be done. He said, "There's a reason truth comes before reconciliation. Efforts to understand how this event happened and how UO botched its response should not end." Brandon Austin, Damian Dotson, and Dominic Artis are the three men accused of the rape, which took place in March of 2014. All three have continued to play college basketball at other schools.
Residents of Roosevelt, Washington, a small town about 140 miles east of Portland, have been evacuated due to wildfire, say state officials. The Highway 8 fire currently covers about 10,000 acres and is 0% contained. Firefighters are working to carve what is known as a fire break between the town and the fire. Wind gusts up to 30 miles an hour are complicating firefighting efforts. Experts have said that 2015's fire season has been off to a, quote, ferocious start, and that more acres burned in June and July than burned in the last two Junes and Julys combined. Record-setting temperatures and a dry season that began 3 months early are to blame, said Peter Goldmark, Washington State Commissioner of Public Lands. The Union of Concerned Scientists, a climate change activism group, says that global warming has caused fire season to last 2 months longer in the 21st century than it did just 40 years ago.
Elsewhere in California, a wildfire has forced the evacuation of more than 13,000 people. At least two dozen homes have been destroyed. The fire has burned nearly 97 square miles of brush and timber. The fire spread rapidly and has caught firefighters off guard and has shocked residents. It even jumped a highway that had previously served as a containment line. The cause of this fire is still unknown. More than 9,000 firefighters, many of them from Washington and Oregon, are on the scene. Over 6,000 structures, homes, barns, sheds, and other buildings remain under threat. No serious injuries have been reported, but a Forest Service firefighter from South Dakota died last week in a different fire.
An article appeared in today's Guardian highlighting the fact that the mere presence of weapons in a law enforcement context makes it more likely that people involved in the situation will become aggressive and violent. KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with PSU professor Tom Hastings about the article and its relation to efforts to overturn the recent decision by the Board of Trustees of PSU to arm campus security personnel.
I'm Jimmy Tardy. I'm joined in the studio by Tom Hastings. He's a professor at PSU in the Conflict Resolution Department. And we're talking today about an article that appeared in The Guardian titled "Mere Sight of a Gun Makes Police and Public More Aggressive," experts say. It's written by Alan Juhas. He's a reporter for The Guardian who works in New York City. And in the article, Mr. Juhas reaches out to a variety of researchers, academia, and one in particular is Ohio State psychology professor Brad Bushman, which is sort of the impetus for this article. Mr. Bushman says that research has shown humans respond as quickly to guns as to spiders and snakes. And he's quoted as saying that weapons increase all of these aggressive thoughts, feeling, hostile appraisals, and the type of thinking that somebody's out to get you or wants to hurt you. This relates to work that Tom is doing both in the Conflict Resolution Department and also as part of the effort called Disarm PSU, which is seeking to overturn the decision by the Board of Trustees of PSU to arm campus safety. It's a recent decision, and the campus safety officers have recently been armed with sidearms. Tom, thanks for joining me. And tell me, just to start with, what are your thoughts on this article?
Well, I think it's really helpful that The Guardian is accessing the researchers. There are several articles quoted, and he actually spoke to some of the researchers themselves. So it was a good piece of journalism. He seemed to try to talk with researchers and professors who study this from several different angles. So I'm pretty impressed with the journalism, and the actual findings are, I think they're pretty important and worth considering, because when the research shows, as you mentioned, that testosterone levels go shooting up, that people become more aggressive when they see weaponry, then we should think about that. And is that the kind of environment that we want in a learning institution, in a campus environment of higher education, where we're supposed to have critical thinking, free discussion, all points of view, academic freedom, and people running around with big guns? That doesn't add up for me, and it certainly doesn't add up for the students I talk with, and it certainly doesn't add up for the faculty. Faculty Senate voted against this. Two student polls revealed a majority of students were against this.
That was KBOO's Jimmy Tardy speaking with Professor Tom Hastings of PSU's Conflict Resolution Department regarding an article by Adam Juhas entitled "Mere Sight of a Gun Makes Police and Public More Aggressive," Experts Say. An extended version of the interview will be played on tomorrow's newscast.
Police in a suburb of Nashville, Tennessee were called out to a scene that's becoming more and more common. A man entered a movie theater with a gun, a hatchet, some pepper spray, and two backpacks with the intent to harm moviegoers at a showing of the new Mad Max movie. Several people have been treated for exposure to pepper spray, and it appears that at least one person was superficially wounded with the hatchet that the attacker was carrying. Police arrived swiftly at the scene, and the suspect started a shootout with one of the responding officers. The suspect was eventually killed by SWAT members inside the theater. Currently, officials are still trying to make sure that there is no danger from the backpacks the man had brought into the theater. This latest shooting comes roughly 2 weeks after a shooting in Louisiana, where a man opened fire on moviegoers at a screening of Trainwreck. After the shooting at the Trainwreck movie, Amy Schumer, the film's star, held a press conference in New York with her cousin, politician Chuck Schumer, to call on the government for better gun control and better oversight in mental health regulations.
The family of Samuel Dubose, who was shot by University of Cincinnati police last month, has taken the first steps toward filing a wrongful death lawsuit. The lawsuit has not yet been filed, but Dubose's mother has retained counsel and asked a judge to allow her to oversee his estate. Dubose, who was black, was shot and killed by Officer Ray Tensing, who was white, during a traffic stop. Tensing claimed that he fired his gun after being dragged by Dubose's car, but video from the scene appears to refute that claim. Tensing has been charged with murder.
The trial has begun for a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black man in 2013. Randall Carrick, the white police officer, is facing charges of voluntary manslaughter for shooting 24-year-old Jonathan Farrell. Farrell was looking for help from a neighbor after a car crash when he was mistaken for a robber and the police were called. According to prosecutors, when the officers arrived, one pointed a taser at Farrell's chest, causing him to flee in fear and to attempt to hide between the two police cars. Randall Carrick then opened fire, shooting Farrell 12 times. Prosecutor Adrian Harris says that any agitation by Farrell was because the crash was so violent that he lost his cell phone and had to kick out a window to escape. Carrick's lawyer has a very different story to tell and claims that as officers arrived at the scene, Farrell yelled, quote, "shoot him," and then charged at Carrick and tried to grab his gun. Lawyers on both sides say video from dashboard cameras will support their version of the events. However, the footage has never been made public. If he is convicted, Officer Carrick could face up to 11 years in prison.
The mother of Sandra Bland has filed a lawsuit over the death of her daughter, who was found dead in a Texas cell last month. Authorities have said Bland committed suicide in her jail cell after being held for failing to signal a lane change. However, her family has disputed these claims. The wrongful death suit filed yesterday argues that Bland should not have been arrested in the first place, as the officer used an inappropriate level of force during the arrest. The suit also states that Bland was placed in a cell containing garbage bags and exposed beams, even after she told authorities she had attempted suicide in the past. Here's Geneva Reed Veal, Sandra Bland's mother, and Cannon Lambert, the lawyer on the case, announcing their decision to file a wrongful death suit.
What happened to my daughter? What happened to Sandy Bland? As a mother, my inner is telling me that she did not do that. Now, I'm the first one to tell you, if the facts, I'm not talking about the fiction, if the facts show, without a doubt, that that was the case, you know, I'll have to be prepared to deal with that. But the bottom line is, she never should have been inside of the jail, period. I've watched the video once. I will not watch it again. Anger, disgust, disappointment, and sadness. Those are my feelings. I have chosen to channel those feelings in another way. So while you won't see me screaming, yelling, shouting, that's not my MO, but I am angry. And so justice is going to be served if the justice system will do what it's supposed to do.
The reality of it is that as much as we've been asking for information, we've not yet gotten it. This family is a reasonable family. This family is a logical family. This family just wants to know what happened. And so in the face of the person they knew, in the face of Sandy being the light that she was, it is very difficult for them to get their minds around the notion that she would hurt herself. At the same time, this family is aware of the possibility. And if they're shown information that points to that effect, these women are prepared to manage and deal with whatever comes their way. We are looking for Waller County and the individuals involved in this situation to take accountability. This family is frustrated. They're frustrated because we don't feel like that has happened. Mr. Insignia is still employed. And it just doesn't make sense that taxpayers would be paying for the type of service that he offered on the 10th of July. It's just not fair. We know that it's the type of thing that can be done, that he could be relieved from his responsibilities. Look at Cincinnati. That's bold, decisive action. We're asking for bold, decisive action. The fact that it hasn't happened yet is a frustrating thing. And we hope that that will come in the coming days.
That was the mother of Sandra Bland speaking about her daughter's death, as well as her lawyer, Cannon Lambert.
A white policeman in a small Alabama town was allegedly recorded threatening to murder a local black man, but kept his job and continues to be on the police force today. Officer Troy Middlebrooks also proposed staging the murder to make it look like self-defense. The threats were secretly recorded by a family member of the target, Vincent Bias, while Middlebrooks was at his home investigating an unleashed dog. When local officials heard the recording, their response was to not fire the Middlebrooks, but rather to offer Bias $35,000 in hopes of settling a potentially embarrassing lawsuit. Alexander City Police Chief Willie Robinson said that Middlebrooks was just talking. Bias doesn't see it that way. He told a reporter, quote, "This town is ridiculous. The police here feel they can do whatever they want, and often they do." To the moon in the middle of the night, say, come on, Jack, what do you know? What you seen now, where we go? Come on, boys, I gotta tell you true. I'm a stranger here just like you. I get high as the morning.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview by Mike Crenshaw. This will be followed by Treasures from the Archive at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 83, moving to 57 and clear at night. Today in history, in 1962, actress and model Marilyn Monroe was found dead in her home in Brentwood, Los Angeles, an event that has become the center of one of the most debated conspiracy theories in modern times. Quote of the day is from Terry Pratchett. It's not worth doing something unless you were doing something that someone, somewhere, would much rather you weren't doing.
It is 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
This is odd. America's laws to deter corporate crime actually force victims to help subsidize the criminals. Follow the bouncing ball here. First, a court orders a corporation to pay punitive damages to a victim of its criminal acts. Second, the corporate offender pays up, then merely subtracts a big chunk of that payment from its income tax, effectively taking money out of our public treasury. Third, while the criminal is counting its tax break, the victim is notified that the punitive damage money he or she received from the corporation will be taxed as regular income. Fourth, that means a big chunk of the victim's payment actually goes to replenish the public money the corporate villain subtracted. Bad enough that corporate finance lawmakers legalize such encouragement of criminality, but corporate coddling judges are playing the same disgraceful game by drastically reducing the amounts that juries order corporations to pay. In a Montana case, for example, a jury awarded $240 million in punitive damages to the families of three people, including two teenagers, killed in a car crash. The deaths were blamed on a steering defect that South Korean automaker Hyundai was found to have known about and recklessly ignored for more than a decade. But a district judge has since supplanted the jury's ruling with her own, while declaring that Hyundai's, quote, reprehensibility certainly warrants a sizable punishment, she cut the corporation's punitive payment down to $73 million. Hello, that's not punishment to a $79 billion a year car giant. It's pocket change. Why would Hyundai executives quit putting corporate profits over people's lives if that's their, quote, punishment? This is Jim Hightower saying, with subsidies and wrist slaps, the corporate criminal whirligig will continue to spin, making a mockery of justice.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Washington Post is reporting that the FBI has opened a search into the private emails set up Hillary Clinton used while she served as Secretary of State. The probe is investigating whether any classified material that may have moved through the private server was handled improperly. The FBI's interest comes after the issue was referred to the Justice Department last month. Intelligence officials expressed concern that the sensitive information was not in the government's hands and could be compromised. The investigation does not accuse Clinton of any wrongdoing, and officials say the FBI is not targeting her. Nick Merrill, a spokesperson for Clinton's campaign, says that Clinton did not send nor receive any emails that were marked classified at the time. He wants to ensure that appropriate procedures are followed as these emails are reviewed, while not unduly delaying the release of her emails. He wants that to happen as quickly and as transparently as possible.
And now for a two-minute lesson in labor history brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1981. It was a dark day in U.S. labor history. Nearly 13,000 members of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization had been out on strike for 2 days. At issue were working conditions and hours. More than 6,000 flights were canceled on the first day of the strike alone. President Ronald Reagan held a press conference at the White House's Rose Garden to address the work stoppage. He declared that the strike constituted a peril to national safety. He also announced that strikes by federal workers were illegal. Although this was technically true, federal workers had participated in more than 20 strikes and sick-outs in the years leading up to the Patco walkout. Yet President Reagan seized on the opportunity to bust the union. And in what has been called the shot heard round the boardroom, he announced that every Patco worker that did not return to work within 48 hours would be fired. He made good on his promise, and more than 11,000 air traffic controllers lost their jobs. The president also decreed that the strikers could never be rehired. By October, the Federal Labor Relations Authority had decertified the union. President Reagan's actions had a chilling impact on the labor movement. Before Patco, there were 300 major strikes on average in the United States each year. Afterwards, that number dropped to 30. 3 decades after the decision, Joseph McCartin, a professor at Georgetown University, described the impact in a New York Times article, writing, "More than any other labor dispute of the past 3 decades. Reagan's confrontation with the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, or PATCO, undermined the bargaining power of American workers and their labor unions." Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The 12-nation trade agreement is on ice. It was supposed to be finalized at a summit of trade ministers in Hawaii at the end of July, but it ended without a deal and without any further dates set for negotiation. The talks have been conducted entirely in secret, but news reports pointed to a variety of issues that caused the breakdown. The U.S. is unwilling to open up its protected sugar market to Australia. Canada is unwilling to open up its protected dairy market to New Zealand. Mexico is concerned about duty-free imports of Japanese cars made with parts from Thailand, and multiple countries are unwilling to go along with the U.S. demand for a 12-year patent monopoly on new drugs. Meanwhile, on the same day the talks ended, WikiLeaks released classified evidence revealing that the NSA had conducted surveillance on Japanese trade negotiators, action which will not help grow an atmosphere of trust going forward. Another issue, inclusion of human rights abuser Malaysia in the trade partnership, is also causing dissension among supporters. It's possible that the TPP may not be passed during President Obama's presidency, even with the passage of fast-track processing, since it would not be voted on until 2016, and the unpopular trade deal is less likely to be passed during an election year.
4 conservation groups filed a formal notice of intent to sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to strengthen protections for the streaked horned lark, a bird that has lost 98% of its grassland habitat. The lawsuit will challenge an October 2013 decision by the agency to classify the lark as threatened rather than endangered. This lower status exempts all agriculture, chemical spraying, and airport activities from the prohibitions of the Endangered Species Act, regardless of whether they harm the lark. Noah Greenwald of the Center for Biological Diversity says protecting the streaked horned lark under the Endangered Species Act means nothing if all of its threats are exempted from protection. The lark exemption seriously threatens the survival of these handsome, horned songbirds. The lark was once so abundant around Puget Sound that it was considered a nuisance around the turn of the century. Today, reduction of its habitat has decimated its numbers. In Washington, it currently breeds at only 10 sites. The groups on the lawsuit are the Cascadia Wildlands, Center for Biological Diversity, Northwest Environmental Defense Center, and Oregon Wild. And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. IBEW President Lonnie Stevenson says his union remains concerned that President Obama's plan for reducing emissions at power plants substitutes wishful thinking for reality, threatening grid reliability and good jobs. The IBEW says America needs a genuinely balanced energy policy that combats climate change while ensuring reliability and protecting good energy jobs. The union says it welcomes several changes the EPA regulators did implement based on union input. They include flexible deadlines for states to meet emissions implementation plans, credits for zero-carbon nuclear power, and a safety valve that protects existing coal plants critical to power grid reliability. With organizing wins at digital media companies Gawker and Salon.com under its belt, the Writers Guild of America East says it won't stop there. Lowell Peterson is executive director of the union.
At both Gawker and Salon, the editorial staff folks themselves were very politically conscious, and I think we can give our organizers a lot of credit, but we also have to give the rank and file a lot of credit for self-organizing. At both of these digital news outlets, people pulled themselves together. They understood the union message, they understood the value of having a voice on the job, and even now, you know, as we prepare for negotiations at both shops, there's a lot of solidarity, a lot of interest in sticking together and getting a good contract.
Peterson says there's real opportunity for unions to continue to organize the digital mediascape.
I think that the recent victories hopefully will inspire people to say, I can actually do this. This is something I can accomplish. This isn't a pipe dream. This isn't a relic of the 1930s. This is real. Collective bargaining is achievable and meaningful, and let me do it. And there's just huge numbers of people ready to be organized out there. We have tremendous support amongst our own rank and file for organizing in digital, for organizing in nonfiction reality TV, for just expanding the scope of the union.
New York's Labor Press reports that members of New York City's building trade unions were excluded from a Columbia University public construction forum July 29th. That forum was jointly sponsored by Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning and Preservation and JDS Development. JDS Development is involved in numerous big-time building projects throughout the city. JDS has been cited multiple times for federal and city safety violations on its work sites, including an OSHA investigation into the death of a 27-year-old construction worker killed at a West 37th Street site in 2014.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Dutch have been getting a lot of attention lately, especially in social media, for their exploration of future energy technologies. One of the most publicized ideas has been a 230-foot bike path that was installed in November of last year. The bike path was a system of solar cells embedded in concrete and covered with tempered glass. The project, when fully completed, will be a solar road that is 560 feet long, with a price tag of $3.7 million. Ultimately, the panels have been found to be unfeasible with current solar technology. In addition to the high price tag, when the panels become dirty, cracked, or covered by shade, the efficiency of the panels are heavily affected. Now, new solar panels installed in the Netherlands may offer a cheaper and more attractive option. Researchers at Eindhoven University have developed a new panel that is coated with red, yellow, or translucent plastic to help make the panels more aesthetic. The researchers hope that more attractive panels will help to encourage people to use solar panels. The group has installed the panels alongside a Dutch highway to test them. In addition to being more visually appealing, the panels may also help to block noise coming from the freeway. On average, the panels perform at about 50% of current solar technologies, as the colored plastic reduces the light spectrum hitting the panels.
Pope Francis is urging priests to welcome divorced Catholics and their children with open arms. In a general address, Francis told priests to be merciful and to encourage divorced families to participate in church life as much as possible. Some believe that Francis may try to push for divorced and remarried Catholics to receive Holy Communion again. Right now, only divorced Catholics who do not remarry can receive communion. Pope Francis says that people who start a new union after the defeat of their sacramental marriage are not at all excommunicated, and they absolutely must not be treated that way. Though their unions are contrary to the sacrament of marriage, the Church, as a mother, seeks the good and salvation of all her children. Recently, the Church has closely focused on family affairs. In October, Church leaders will be debating social issues such as divorce, same-sex civil unions, and single parenting.
Russia filed documents with the United Nations seeking to claim ownership of nearly a 500,000 square miles of Arctic territory. If granted exclusive access to the area, Russia estimates that it will gain access to nearly 5 billion metric tons of petroleum resources. According to the Russian government, their research shows that the continental shelf that Russia sits on extends far into the Arctic. Current international law says that a country may control continental shelves within 200 miles of its shoreline. Many Arctic countries have been pushing to expand the 200-mile limit, largely due to Arctic ice melt, leading to new shipping routes and greater access to oil deposits. Russia previously filed the same claim in 2001, and the proposal was rejected, as much of the research used in the claim was outdated information from the Soviet Union. Since that time, the Russian government has sent 9 expeditions, costing nearly $150 million, to update its research. It may take as long as 3 years for the United Nations to study their proposal. Russia has suggested that if the plan is approved, it would border off its Arctic areas from other countries, and that access to the pole would have to be diplomatically adjudicated. Greenpeace has expressed worries about the exploitation of mineral resources in the Arctic, saying that turning the area is highly susceptible to climate change.
Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram has crossed into Cameroon to commit violence for the second time in as many months. A Cameroonian military officer said at least 7 people were dead and that as many as 20 abducted from a town in the northern part of the African country. Last month, a spate of suicide bombings killed hundreds of people in northern Cameroon. The attacks were performed mostly by young women believed to have been associated with Boko Haram. Since the attacks, the local authorities have banned the wearing of the burqa, a traditional garment worn by some Muslim women to cover their entire bodies. Boko Haram is a Nigerian Islamist group that has been conducting an insurgency in that country for 6 years. It may be best known for its abduction last year of more than 200 schoolgirls, most of whom are believed to have been forced into marriage or killed.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imenc.org for Wednesday, August 5th, 2015. Israeli settlers step up attacks targeting West Bank communities and soldiers demolish Palestinian homes. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli authorities on Wednesday demolished 7 Palestinian-owned agricultural structures in the village of Al-Aqaba, northern Jordan Valley, in addition to serving Hebron-area Palestinians demolition notices regarding 20 homes, according to local sources. An Israeli army force broke into the village in the morning and demolished 7 agricultural structures used as grain storage sheds and as animal shelters. Forces further uprooted an electricity pole in the village. Meanwhile, in Al-Arub refugee camp to the north of Hebron, Israeli bulldozers demolished a house under construction, citing unpermitted construction as a pretext. The army also notified Palestinians in the camp of their intentions to demolish 20 homes under the same pretext. Early on Wednesday, Israeli forces abducted 10 Palestinians, including at least a minor, from West Bank districts. Invasions and home searches were reported in Jenin, Nablus, and Hebron cities. Local sources said that among those kidnapped were a father and his son from Hebron City. Also on Wednesday at dawn, Israeli Jewish settlers attacked Palestinian homes with stones located in the outskirts of Siliyat al-Dahr, some 20 kilometers to the south of Jenin in northern West Bank. The settlers, who also chanted racist slogans against Arabs and Palestinians, provocated a scuffle with angry local Palestinians who forced them out of the area. In related news, Israel used a controversial administrative detention without trial against an alleged Jewish extremist for the first time following international outcry over the death of a Palestinian toddler in an arson attack. The use of administrative detention, which has been applied to thousands of Palestinians, came as Israeli authorities arrested another suspected Jewish extremist and extended the detention of a leader of a radical religious group. According to AFP, none of the 3 were accused of direct involvement in last week's firebombing of a Palestinian home in the occupied West Bank, in which a 19-month-old toddler was killed. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, August 5th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Maui and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joseph Jordan, Jimmy Tardy, Jimmy Thompson, Shade Samuelson, and Joe. The producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineer is June Siegel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO in Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up Thursday morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Per Fagerang hosts Fight the Empire, connecting history with the latest world events. At 10, Air Cascadia is off. We'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein instead. And at 11 on Between the Covers, host David Nyman speaks with the award-winning writer Rebecca Mackay, whose stories have appeared in four consecutive editions of the Best American Short Stories, about her new collection, Music for Wartime. And at 11, Patricia Welch, O.B. Hill, and Emma Jackson Ford host Black Book Talk, a monthly program featuring interviews and discussions of works by African-American authors. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
So without further ado, I would love to get into the conversation with you, Alyssa Pagan. How are you doing today?
I am all right. Thank you.
Good, good. So we talked briefly. Teresa Rayford gave me your contact because I was wanting to have somebody on from Don't Shoot Portland, Black Lives Matter. And I was excited to get your contact, and we communicated a little bit, and you let me know about a few different campaigns that you've been part of. The Fight for 15, Black Lives Matter, and then also a campaign to try to prevent PSU security from being armed. Would you like to talk a little bit about any of that?
Yeah, well, the last one, unfortunately, is we're past the point of prevention. The undemocratically elected PSU Board of Trustees has really steamrolled the entire process against the will of students, staff, and faculty. I feel like my job at this point is to highlight some of the really gross ways that they intentionally undercut and ignored any dissenting voices. Many of the members on the board are developers and have a vested interest in militarizing our campus in order to make their developments more attractive to investors.
Okay. Well, you just named something that I talk about often, which is the connection between private interests and corporate interests, what happens legally and how that relates to the policing of our people and of everybody, really. As far as the liberation of all black lives, how does the liberation of not only black male lives, but black queer people's lives, black trans people's lives, tie into the liberation of all humanity? I'm sure you've heard people say things like, well, why has it got to be Black Lives Matter? And why can't it be All Lives Matter? Or why does it have to be all Black Lives Matter? Can you speak on that?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, because All Lives Matter is a real pebble in my shoe. Something that we often say is, of course, all lives matter. We know that. We in the movement, we care about everyone. We want the liberation of all people. But unfortunately, police departments across the country and across the world and the people who they take their directives from do not know that, do not think that. So we have to assert it. And we know how absurd it sounds, but we have to say it because it's not being shown in our everyday lives.
Okay.
I encourage people all the time to visit the website, killedbypolice.net. The people who run the site go and search the internet every day for stories in the news, the ones that make it to the news, mm-hmm. about when police use deadly force. And, of course, they use deadly force disproportionately against black people. And the fact that this is so prevalent and seems so natural in our society is the reason that we have to scream Black Lives Matter, the reason we have to shut down. I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry that we are holding up your traffic, your intersections, your bridges. But this is what we have to do until the powers that be do realize that all lives matter, including black people, because as it stands right now, they do not realize it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll scream it until they do.
So what is the connection between violence against trans men and women, black men and women, black trans men and women, and police terror?
Yeah, I am a black trans woman. I can speak a little bit to my experience with horrendous police, mainly the NYPD. I'm from New Jersey, in case people cannot hear that already. The policing of bodies is so intrinsic to every department to say that everyone gets treated equally.